thanks for those of you who've sent me questions and started discussions. Also, thanks to those of you who attended office hours last week. So I realized that maybe I brushed over a few things fairly rapidly in the two lectures last week. So this is why I wanted to make some additional comments and sort of point out a few things in addition before we move on. So the first thing I wanted to point out is essentially that I just wanted to point out again the sort of concept of entropy solutions, and just wanted to stress again the fact that an entropy solution is defined as a weak solution that satisfies these entropy inequalities here. So I just copied here the definition from the last lecture. So it satisfies these entropy inequalities for any entropy pair, for any entropy pair that you can write down for a given conservation law. And so this condition essentially restores, is sort of the condition that we're looking for, that restores uniqueness for weak solutions. So in the case of weak solutions. And so this is the other sort of connection to the viscosity method that we discussed last time, was that we showed essentially that through the viscosity method, so by adding a viscosity term to the conservation laws, looking at classical solutions of that version, and then taking this viscosity limit of viscosity goes to zero, we were showing that this limit corresponds to such an entropy solution. So we can use these entropy inequalities and entropy pairs to test whether we have actually found such a limit, or in other words, such an entropy, unique entropy solution to our conservation law. So this is why we typically, or why one typically takes some entropy pair that you can write down, and then typically you apply those inequalities to a given solution, and you test sort of whether or not that solution actually satisfies the inequality, and thereby you can sort of exclude some candidates, or you can sort of admit them. And so this is also why these criteria are sometimes called admission or admissibility criteria. So let me just start writing a few remarks down. So first I wanted to again touch upon this uniqueness idea, noting that the entropy solution is a weak solution that satisfies the entropy inequalities . I should stress this for any entropy pair. We call them phi and psi of the conservation law. And so for 1D scalar equations, I actually wrote down the theorem last time. There's a statement that there exists at most one weak solution. It satisfies the entropy inequalities for all entropy pairs. Of the conservation law. And so this means that we can take one, as I said, one entropy pair. And so one entropy pair may essentially already be sufficient or essentially to sufficient to rule out a given weak solution as an entropy solution. And then in general, this uniqueness statement holds also for systems of conservation laws, but only in 1D. So as long as we stay in one spatial dimension. So there we have a similar result. Although showing this is actually much more involved and needs a lot more machinery. So I think I pointed out a reference where you can actually look up the proof for the scalar case. And that is still something that is fairly elementary and one can go through it. It's just very long and so too long to be sort of repeated here and it would sort of sidetrack us. But this is still something one can actually sort of easily go through and read. So for systems, things become a little more involved. And then interestingly, so if one goes to multi-dimensions and looks at systems in multi-dimensions, then such uniqueness results are in general still an open problem actually. Now, the next point I wanted to comment on is the existence of entropy pairs, because one might wonder, like, how can I actually test whether I have an admissible solution? So do I actually have entropy pairs at hand with which I could actually test those? So here, essentially, the situation is the following. So if we are, again, in the 1D case, so m equals 1, we have just one equation. You can essentially take any convex function, phi, so whose second derivative is positive, and then you can easily obtain a corresponding entropy flux by just integrating this function according to the definition of entropy and entropy flux pairs. So this would be, so psi prime, so the derivative of psi has to equal the derivative of phi times the derivative of the flux of the equation. So here, you're in R. So maybe I should just pull up the definition of, if you remember, this was our definition of entropy and entropy flux pairs. And so the condition was that the entropy be convex, and then also that essentially this identity holds here. And so in 1D, this is just the multiplication of the first derivatives. So you can simply integrate that relation to obtain the actual entropy flux psi. So in 1D, there's no big problem, and for scalar systems. Now, if we go to systems of conservation laws, if we have two equations, so m equal 2, one can in general still find such entropy flux pairs So we are looking for phi and psi with phi a convex function. So now in more than one equation, this means that the Hessian of phi is actually positive everywhere. And so the defining equation again is essentially that the gradient here of phi multiplied by the Jacobian of our flux of the conservation law must equal the gradient of psi. So here we're in R2. So this is d phi. Again, this is the defining equation. And so here we have two unknowns, phi and psi, and two equations. So we can hope to find the solution in general. But if we go to sort of more than two equations, then the system is overdetermined. So in general, we cannot expect actually to find an entropy and entropy flux pair. Now, luckily, in hydrodynamics, we actually do have an entropy flux pair that we can write down. And this is, as I mentioned last time, that is the actual thermodynamic entropy. So thanks to the second law of thermodynamics, we can actually write down a function that satisfies these conditions, and that will actually never decrease. So essentially phi of u will be defined to be actually minus the thermodynamic entropy. So because the mathematical entropy here is defined essentially to never increase, so to only decrease. And so here's a minus sign involved. I think I forgot to point this out last time as well. So the mathematical entropy can only decrease. So we have this up here, right? So where we have smaller equal than zero. So there's a minus sign involved here. And so finally, I wanted to also comment on the physical interpretation of this whole sort of viscosity limit method. So in terms of the entropy and entropy flux pairs, we already found essentially a physical interpretation. So the thermodynamic entropy that is available for hydrodynamical problems. So when our conservation laws are related to the Euler equations. Also this idea of viscosity, of this viscosity limit that I pointed out last time has a nice physical interpretation. And thanks, Eric, for pointing this out. I should have mentioned this last time as well. Namely, one can essentially think of this viscosity limit, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, essentially, this viscosity limit as being a classical solution to the Navier-Stokes equations. And then just taking the limit of that classical solution to the Navier-Stokes equations of the viscosity going to zero, and then obtaining a unique weak solution the so-called entropy solution to the Euler equations. So let me just write this down as well. Note that on the Euler equations, is the unique solution to the 1D Navier-Stokes equation in the limit in which we take the viscosity to zero. So essentially we have the following situation. We have the Navier-Stokes equations and so particularly in the incompressible case, we can write down write them down in the following form, essentially, where we have essentially something that looks like the Euler equations, like a conservation law. And then we have we add some viscosity term here on the right hand side with some fluid viscosity epsilon. And we can look for a classical solution of the system, which exists according to a theorem that we that I mentioned one or two lectures ago. So we can look for classical solution here. And we take the viscosity as a parameter, epsilon. So this is, the solution is unique. And then we can take the limit of epsilon goes to zero and we obtain a unique solution to the Euler equations. Maybe I should put this down here. And so this is our entropy solution, which in the 1D case is guaranteed to be unique as well, according to the theorems that we discussed last time. So this is essentially the situation and the motivation behind this viscosity method that mathematicians apply to all sorts of general conservation laws. So not obviously not just to the Euler and Navier-Stokes equations, but sort of to general conservation laws. And sort of this analogy is also provides some additional sort of physical motivation for this mathematical recipe of restoring uniqueness in the weak solution space to general conservation laws.
So Daniel, if we stick to Navier-Stokes and Euler, do you know if there's a uniqueness statement for higher dimensions?
Yeah, that is a good question. I don't know off the top of my head, to be honest. I would have to look this up. I believe, obviously, that people have tried to prove this, but I'm not sure what the actual status is. I mean, this is still a fairly active field of research, actually, in applied mathematics, and so things are changing there as well. And I don't know exactly what the status is.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Daniel.
Yes, Boris.
On something we wrote in part two, we said for more than two dimensions, the system's overdetermined. Why is that?
So because we're looking for these two scalar functions, phi and psi, and so we have two equations, right? And so if we go to sort of higher, so to m greater than two or so, let me just write this down here. So then, you know, we have more equations. So we have a matrix equation essentially that, you know, for example, for m equals three or so, you know, we have a system like this, right? And so we have three equations for two unknowns. And so it's not guaranteed that we find something that's consistent. So this is, sorry?
Yeah, I see, thanks.
Right, exactly. So this is why in general, in for, so even for the Euler equations, which as you know, is would be like a three dimension, so M equals three system, even there, according to this basic definition of entropy and entropy flux pairs, it is not obvious that you can actually write down something. But luckily, as I said, for in this physical case where we know the second law of thermodynamics, we can actually write down an entropy entropy flux pair for that equation. Any other questions? Anything related to this, entropy solutions, viscosity limit, things like that?
I take it you're going to go back to the Lax. I forgot how you called it, the Lax entropy or whatever.
Right. Yes. So I think you're alluding to the Lax entropy conditions.
Right. So I guess I'm curious to see how that actually relates to, you know, physical right. entropy.
Yes. So this is actually something that we will get to on Thursday. So I was planning to discuss those on Thursday when we talk about shocks and shock solutions. So today we'll talk about, we'll start with the Riemann problem and discuss rarefaction solutions. And then on Thursday, I wanted to introduce shocks, and then we'll discuss the Lux entropy conditions. So it turns out that one can show that under certain conditions, which we'll specify on Thursday, that the entropy solution or the definition of an entropy solution in this fairly general form that applies to any conservation law, that this is actually equivalent to demanding certain conditions on the eigenvalues of the flux function for a strictly hyperbolic system, and certain other conditions have to apply, and then you can show that there is an equivalence there, and that gives you a fairly sort of a fairly simple criterion at hand at which you can select entropy solutions versus non-entropy solutions. And this is actually part of, so I'm not too familiar with all the historical details there, but so mathematicians have sort of long seen this problem that with weak solutions, there's no uniqueness. And so various attempts have been started and done to try to restrict that solution space by specifying some selection criteria. And so these Lux conditions are, or these Lux entropy conditions are essentially one, you can see, or you can sort of think of them as one, as being one of those selection criteria. And it has only been later then discovered that those are actually equivalent to the sort of more general definition of the of entropy solutions for in the very general case. So we'll discuss this in a little more detail on Thursday. Okay, if there are no further questions on this, if something comes up, then sort of please let me know. I'm happy to go over a few things. Also feel free to sort of drop in tomorrow during office hours and ask questions if anything comes up in the meanwhile. If there are no further questions on viscosity limits and entropy solutions, then I would start continuing with the Riemann problem that I quickly started last time by just giving an example in the scalar conservation law case of the Invisit-Burgers equation. And so now would be a good time to start talking about the general case of the Riemann problem for systems of conservation laws. So just to reiterate on this and point out again the definition, essentially what we define as the Riemann problem is the following initial value problem. So let's say we have a system of conservation laws. And so we can always write them in the following way, where u is obviously a vector in this case. And the specific initial value problem that we're interested in is the one defined by piecewise constant initial data of the following form. So we have u naught is some constant ul, u left for x smaller than zero, and some constant u right for x greater than zero, with ul and ur constant vectors. And so this was introduced by Riemann back in 1860. So it's actually a very old problem. So I'm not entirely sure, actually, I'm not entirely familiar with the historical details of how he arrived at this and how he sort of considered this problem. So Eric actually made me curious, and so now I'm going to look up some historical material on this. So I believe Riemann was actually working on some parabolic problems, and he was actually finding new ways to write down solutions for parabolic problems, so for the heat equation, essentially. And this is probably how he got interested in thermodynamics, but I'm not entirely sure. It's just a hypothesis at this point. So this is essentially the problem that we are looking at. And it is very important, as I pointed out last time already, that because this will really be the centerpiece for numerical algorithms to solve conservation laws. In particular, for those algorithms that try to ensure that shocks, so nonlinearities, are sort of captured by the numerical algorithm by design. So essentially, these algorithms sort of decompose the numerical evolution problem into individual Riemann problems at every given cell, and then sort of putting together these local Riemann problems, the solutions to these local Riemann problems, to a global solution. So this is essentially the basic idea of these so-called Godunov-type schemes that we'll discuss starting next week. So those are essentially the basis for most computational algorithms in hydrodynamics these days. But for now, bear with me as we'll go through some of the sort of more formal or mathematical details on this. Some of which is certainly relevant to understand the numerical algorithm. So this is why I thought it would be interesting to actually introduce this, at least to some extent. So I know that sort of following a few subsections will be sort of a little technical, and so some of the actual insights might get buried sort of in some of the technicalities or in some of the sort of details that that we'll write down. So I thought that maybe I should start sort of by drawing a little sketch, which is essentially the way I like to think about this. So this is essentially sort of more a geometric way to think about the Riemann problem. So I will just sketch here the idea, and we'll fill in much more details later, and I'll come back to this basic sketch essentially at the end of the chapter. But so the basic problem that we want to look at here is, given a general conservation law, looking in state space, so in the space where our solution vector u lives of the conserved variables, right? Given some initial state on the left side of for our initial data ul, so let's denote this at some point in this state space. We want to study essentially the problem of what happens to this initial data if we choose some sort of other state u right. Say let's say this is our ur. And we want to find essentially the solution to the initial value problem posed essentially by these two points. And so the question is, what is can we actually analytically write down a solution to this problem? And does such a solution exist? And the answer to these two questions is essentially to the first one, yes, and to the second one, yes and no. So we will actually see that a solution to the Riemann problem in general only exists in a small neighborhood in state space of this say UL, for example, so depending on which state we start with. So if we want to if we fix UL and we want to specify another state U right for which a solution to this problem exists, we can only go a finite amount away from that point. So this is what I try to define here as say this region D or so. And the idea of how we can construct a solution to this is essentially based on the following idea. What we'll see is that you can actually define integral curves of eigenvectors of our flux, of the Jacobian of our flux function. So remember, for a hyperbolic system, we have a complete set of eigenvectors. And so every eigenvector field defines integral curves. So we can essentially draw these curves, and then, you know, at every point, we'd have the eigenvector at this point as the tangent vector, right? So this is what an integral curve is defined as. And so the realization is essentially that if we move along such an integral curve, and we choose a point on such an integral curve for, we'll denote them actually by capital TK at some point. So every eigenvalue and every comes with its corresponding eigenvector, and that defines an integral curve. So K goes from 1 to M here. And so essentially we'll show later today even that if we go along such an integral curve, then we can actually, in certain cases, write down a solution that is just given by a rarefaction wave, which is a special solution. So we'll look at special solutions in a second. And so we'll start with rarefaction waves and then with shocks and contact discontinuities on Thursday. And so it turns out that as long as we move along such integral curves, which exists because they are solutions to ODEs, and so there's existence and uniqueness theorems for ODEs that can be employed here. So in a finite region around UL, you can follow these integral curves that exist, and you can and the solution to UL and U right on such a curve would be special solutions to the Riemann problem. So it would be a rarefaction wave or a single shock wave. Or a contact discontinuity. Now, if UR, such as here, does not lie on any of such integral curves, then we cannot just write down such a special solution, but we'll actually find that it is kind of like a superposition of such different nonlinear waves. So it turns out that you can think of these integral curves as providing sort of local coordinates in that region D. And so what you can do is you follow essentially along you follow along one of these integral curves, and you introduce an intermediate state, let's call it Z for now, and then you follow the second integral curve to reach UR. And so you can write down a solution to the Riemann problem. So in this case, So in this case that you have some state U left, some state U right, and then you have some shock wave or so, for example, that separates UR from Z, from the intermediate state Z, and then again you have some other nonlinear wave, be it a rarefaction wave, a shock wave, or so, that separates again this intermediate Z state. So let's call it star. So often this is actually denoted by star or so. Sort of separates this Z state from the constant state UL to the right. And so this is essentially how I like to think about this a little geometrically, in a sense. And we'll get back to this in more detail later on, just to give you essentially a primer about this. So for now, I would like to discuss special solutions to the Riemann problem. As I said, those solutions that arise as if we sort of move along some of these integral curves. And we'll see that these are interesting special nonlinear phenomena, such as these rarefaction waves, shock waves, and contact discontinuities. Okay, so let's start. So this is now section 4.4.2. And the first concept I wanted to introduce are Riemann invariants and characteristic fields. So also in this section, I will, in the interest of time and also in order to not get sidetracked with too much sort of mathematical detail, I'm essentially skipping a few things, and we have to take a few things as kind of black boxes, because otherwise we'll have to spend too much time and to introduce too much machinery to actually go through this in great detail. But I have kind of a pedestrian way version in my notes that you can follow, and that sort of goes through all the proofs of everything. But we'll actually not have the time to discuss everything in great detail. But I also think it's not entirely needed. So the first thing I wanted to define is essentially K characteristics. So these are the characteristics that arise in systems of conservation laws, of hyperbolic conservation laws. So I noticed that we haven't actually defined this yet. So this is why I have to write it down here at least once. So let's say we have a at least piecewise smooth solution to the hyperbolic system. So, and we are here in 1D as usual. We'll actually discuss multidimensional systems and corresponding numerical schemes right at the very end of this lecture course. And turns out that essentially, at least on the numerical level, things can be easily and straightforwardly extended to multi-D. So this is sort of why we can work with 1D for now. So since we have a hyperbolic system, we can order the eigenvalues of our of the Jacobian of our flux function in such a way, given some state vector u, and then we define a curve, and so this is just a straightforward generalization from the scalar conservation law case that we've looked at a couple of times. Where gamma k prime is given by the kth eigenvector along the solution. So this is just straightforward generalization of the scalar case, but the interesting important difference is that in general, the solution u of x comma t is not constant along such a characteristic anymore. So we actually made use of that property a couple of times during the last two lectures, and we've also shown this at the very beginning of the lecture course. But here for systems, it is not true in general. But it turns out one can often write down functions of u that are actually that fulfill this property actually that so that are constant along characteristics, and this is the concept of Riemann invariance. Oops. So again, let's say we have, let's say u is denotes our solution. And so here we just assume to be a smooth solution, but it just needs to be locally a smooth solution so that derivatives and things like that are defined. And so let's say we have some k characteristics. Corresponding to the k eigenvalues 1 to m. Let's assume that there exists a following function, a smooth function w, with the following property, namely that essentially the gradient of this function w is an eigenvector to the transpose of the Jacobian of our flux function. Then one can show that w of u is constant along a k characteristic. So in other words, d by dt of w of u along this characteristic, this K characteristic, vanishes. And so this is called and the significance also of these of this in the context of the Riemann problem is that we'll see that these Riemann invariants also have a, another interesting property, namely they are actually constant across a rarefaction wave. So this is something that is a characteristic of rarefaction waves, and that also helps essentially by actually solving the Riemann problem for a rarefaction wave. So I will actually not go through. So one can actually show that this is the case. So this is more like a definition and theorem at once. So we would now have to show that actually this is the case, so that U is actually constant along this. But this essentially just amounts to plugging in straightforward, just some algebra, just plugging in some definitions and making use of the fact that gamma is a K characteristic using the conservation law and so on. So one can actually write this down. Explicitly gamma prime delta T U L delta L W and so on. I won't do this here in the interest of time. It's just simple sort of algebra. You can feel free to do it on your own at some point, or look it up in the in the notes. It's a few lines, but lots of indices, and so it takes a while to do it. So I'll skip it here. Actually, all we really need to know is that these Riemann invariants are constant along characteristics, and now there's another definition that is...
Can I stop you, yeah. Daniel?
Sure, yeah.
So I'm just trying to make sure I understand the notation. So yep. So f is a function in U space, right? It's a function of U.
Yes, correct, yes.
So df would be the Jacobian, right? So it's all
exactly.
The
derivatives. It's an, yes, exactly. So it's an M by M matrix, yeah.
Right, okay. So I can see that this has eigenvalues and eigenvectors. The eigenvectors would be... you know, vectors in U space as well, right?
Correct. Yes.
So W, say that they're equal to grad W. So is grad W defined in U space or in physical space?
So that is in U space.
Oh, it's a gradient in U space.
Yes.
Okay. So how do you know that the eigenvectors are going to be gradients?
The eigenvectors. You mean like whether such a function exists here, such W functions exist that satisfy right. this condition? Yes. So there's an existence theorem for this. So one can actually show that this is the case. You always find functions that satisfy this. Actually, I have. Yes, I have this somewhere down. I'll actually get to this in a couple of minutes. If I don't answer okay. It, then.
So the statement is that the eigenvectors of that matrix are gradients of functions. That's guaranteed.
Yes.
Okay, very good.
So now comes the slightly confusing part. There's a slightly different version of this, which are called the K Riemann invariants. And so again, we consider this our usual conservation law. And so I'll just abbreviate here some notation. And so let's say that RK of U denotes the eigenvectors of our Jacobian corresponding to the eigenvalues lambda k. So we consider an integral curve of these eigenvectors, of these eigenvector fields, essentially, that these RK define. So this is will be some smooth function with the following property, namely that its tangent vector, so its derivative, is always proportional to the eigenvector RK. So here we are now always in state space again, so I'll highlight this here. So the integral curve is defined by this property that V prime is constant proportional to the eigenvector RK at this point, where mu is just a function that essentially parametrizes the curve. So you can sort of choose and simplify as you wish. So mu is sort of not too important for now. So then the definition is the following. A function, again, I'll call it W just to make to increase confusion. So with the following property, namely that the gradient of V is orthogonal to RK along this integral curve, is constant along the integral curve, namely. So here again, I essentially mixed again a definition and actually a statement to show So essentially, the definition is that any W that satisfies this condition, so that is orthogonal to RK along an integral curve, that is called a K-Riemann invariant. And the property that that those functions have is that they're actually constant along the integral curve. And so this can be seen easily. So this is just gradient of W at V of Xi times V prime of Xi. Now we use the fact that V is an integral curve. So we have nabla W at V of Xi times V of Xi RK at V of Xi. And now we're just making use of this property here that the product between the gradient and RK actually vanishes. So this is zero. So these K Riemann invariants don't change along such an integral curve. Okay, so now comes the two remarks on existence and the relation between these K Riemann invariants and what we previously defined as a Riemann invariant. So one can actually show, and I won't do it here because this would be another lengthy theorem to show. But for those who are interested in this, so this is in one of the books that I pointed out as reading material. So this is in Kerner. So since Eric asked before, so this is essentially where one can find some existence statements about these fields. So one can show that there are M minus one K Riemann invariants and one can also show that their gradients are actually orthogonal to each other. So they actually form sort of a basis. Oops. For part of the, so for this M minus one dimensional subspace. Now about the existence of, so now that you're asking, Eric, about the existence of Riemann invariants, I'm actually not too sure. I have to look this up. I'm not aware of an existence, of a general existence statement in that case. But what one can show that if such a Riemann invariant exists, it is automatically a K Riemann invariant. Yeah, so maybe I can just demonstrate this fairly quickly. So let's say we assume such a Riemann invariant W exists. I'll just abbreviate this by RI with respect to, say, some eigenvalue lambda j of U. Then W is a K invariant for all K unequal J. So the starting point essentially here is the following. So let's look at lambda j at v, where v is just some general state vector in Rm. in our solution space. And let's look at the product of RK at this point in solution space with the gradient of our Riemann invariant. And so just making use of the fact that of the definition of the Riemann invariant, we can write this in the following way, times df. Remember, this was an eigenvector of the transpose of the Jacobian, so we can write this as df of vt wv. So in other words, this is df times RK. So I'm just dropping the argument v for now. And now we're making use of the fact that RK is an eigenvector of the Jacobian. So we have just lambda k RK transpose times the gradient of w. So now we see here, if you just combine this part with this part, see that lambda j minus lambda k has to vanish. And so for j unequal k, we have that this has to vanish, which is exactly the definition of a K-Riemann invariant. So long story short, so as just to give you an example, so for the Euler equations, so the contrary is actually not true. So a K-Riemann invariant is not automatically a Riemann invariant. And so you can see that, for example, looking at the Euler equation, the Euler equations, the entropy is actually a Riemann invariant. And then by construction here, so it is also a K Riemann invariant. Some of the K Riemann invariants, so this will be on the next problem set. You'll actually compute the Riemann invariants and K Riemann invariants and so on for the Euler equations, just as an exercise in the next problem set, and you'll see you can actually verify what we've just shown here in a sort of more general context. Okay. Now let's get back to characteristics again. So first, I just wanted to make a quick remark on the following, namely that the change of an eigenvalue lambda k along an integral curve can be easily computed in the following way. So if we look for, if we follow a, and this is another sort of result that we'll need in the following, and that also gives rise to a few definitions. So if we follow an integral curve of one of our eigenvectors of the hyperbolic system, we can show we can compute how the signal speed, essentially lambda k, changes as we go along this integral curve in solution space. And so this is just given by this expression again. And now we make use of the fact that V is an integral curve. So we have again mu of xi, and then so this is a very similar fashion as we just did with the Riemann invariance. And so this gives rise to the, so we have this product here again between the gradient of the signal speeds and in solution space with the eigenvectors. And so depending on what that product is, one sort of distinguishes between the following cases. So this gives rise to this definition of linearly degenerate and generally, so-called generally nonlinear characteristics or characteristic fields. So if we focus on some region in our solution space, and we look at a K characteristic in there, this product can obviously take different values and calls these characteristics or characteristic fields linearly degenerate. If this product actually vanishes, so if the gradient of the signal speed is always orthogonal to the eigenvector. And so here we're just enforcing this essentially on the whole region, because it will turn out that for the Euler equations or so, we can actually we are always in a situation where we can actually require this. And then the other case is where this obviously doesn't vanish, and this is referred to as genuinely nonlinear. And so the terminology, I'll explain the terminology in just a second. So lambda, so the gradient again, is not orthogonal in D. So essentially one can think of this as the signal speed lambda k varying essentially monotonically along the integral curve. So and then in general, a system is called linearly degenerate. If these properties hold for all K characteristics. So the terminology essentially of sort of linearly degenerate or genuinely nonlinear is motivated by the following. So for example, if we look at an actual linear system with constant coefficients, then by construction, we're in the linearly degenerate case, because our Jacobian has constant coefficients. So gradients are zero everywhere. So we're in the sort of corresponds to this linearly degenerate case. And then for nonlinear systems, we can also be in this case. But then only what we require is that that it's constant along a given integral curve, we can still, one could still, so these lambda k could still be sort of different on different integral curves. And this is then essentially why moving to the other limit of genuinely nonlinear, this is why it's called genuinely nonlinear. So that really lambda is also varies along these integral curves and is not just constant, but takes different values on different integral curves. So this is essentially motivates essentially is just genuinely nonlinear. Naming. So for the nonlinear, linearly degenerate lambda k is constant along a given integral curve. But takes different values along different integral curves. Okay, so that's essentially all I wanted to say on these Riemann invariants and some of these properties of lambda k. I mean, so far it's essentially just definitions, and I apologize, this is a little sort of boring, but we will need these terms in the following. So this is why we needed to introduce them here. Any questions on this? So if not, I would sort of just move on and discuss in the last couple of minutes, sort of move on to the first special solution to the Riemann problem, namely rarefaction waves. And as I mentioned earlier, we'll use these special solutions in the end to construct the general and unique solution to the Riemann problem in a general case. Okay, so this starts, not surprisingly, with a definition. So I just wanted to explicitly write down what we mean by rarefaction waves. So this is essentially the following. So let's say we are in some region of our physical space. So this is R cross 0 to infinity. And let's assume that locally on this domain, our solution is actually differentiable and doesn't have a discontinuity. So again, then the k's are again our eigenvalues. Of df. And so the defining property essentially of the solution is the following, namely that if all k Riemann invariants let's call them Wj are constant in this region, so meaning that d by dt of Vj along our solution on the characteristic vanishes. Then the solution U is called a K rarefaction wave. Okay, and so this is essentially to say that so as a sort of defining property of K rarefaction waves, we essentially impose the same property as a solution to scalar conservation laws, namely that the solution U is constant along characteristics. And so we are sort of making this now as a defining property essentially of such rarefaction wave solutions in the context of systems of equations. And so one can then show that the K characteristics in this case are also straight lines, which is exactly the property that we had for scalar equations as well, where characteristics were straight lines. So this is something that essentially is to be expected. So I won't show this here. I just I will just point this out. It's a useful property. Then the K characteristics. Are straight lines. Along which, which the solution U is constant. So in other words, this is, one can also show that essentially this amounts to saying that there's a similarity solution. I'll just try to draw a sketch here to just to illustrate this. So essentially, say if our region, usually what we have is something like this, that our region is sort of something like this, this wedge in our sort of real space x, t. And so these rarefaction waves have the property that they actually a continuous solution. So they are in general continuous. And so if I draw here, so this is typically how these K characteristics would look like. So often one refers to that as like a fan or something like that, a fan-like or wedge-like solution. And so, as I said, they have the properties that these K Riemann invariants are constant in this region D, so all over the place here. And so this is usually also used when actually solving the Riemann problem in practice. So some of these properties will turn out to be useful. Okay. So probably I should stop here because time is up. And show existence of and sort of show the existence and discuss the structure of such rarefaction waves on Thursday. So this is probably what we should start with next time. It would take too long now, and I don't want to go over time too much. So essentially what we will show is that these such rarefaction waves exist if we have genuinely nonlinear characteristic fields. So if we have a pair of an eigenvalue and eigenvector where the gradient is always of the signal speed of the eigenvalue is always orthogonal to RK. Is not orthogonal to RK, I'm sorry, so generally nonlinear, then we can actually define a rarefaction wave solution to the Riemann problem. So this is essentially what we'll show next time, and it will have essentially the structure as shown here, where we have essentially a constant state on the left, we have a constant state on the right, and then we have a part of the solution that is self-similar, so that only depends on x over t. So essentially the solution, let's call it u, is a function of u of x over t. And so the characteristics, as I've drawn here, are straight lines. And so the characteristic speed sort of smoothly, continuously, it's not smooth, but continuously interpolates between the signal speed on the left side on, for the Riemann problem and to the right side on the Riemann problem. So the characteristics, as you see, they are sort of slower to the left, and then sort of they get faster, the signal speed gets faster to the right. And so there's a continuous, essentially, interpolation, if you want, between the two states. And so this is one continuous solution to the specific Riemann problem. More on this next time then. Any questions, final questions or thoughts? Yes, so bear with me a little bit through this sort of more sort of technical or mathematical chapters here. But next week we'll get back to numerics and to more applied things and to more sort of to more physics. Sort of this week we'll go through this Riemann problem and sort of highlight a few sort of a few foundations to this. And the powerful thing about this is really that we're going through this now in a very general way, so that applies to all conservation laws. So if we just understand the general Riemann problem for general conservation laws, we can apply it to all sorts of systems everywhere. Very often, hydrodynamics or the Riemann problem is discussed just along one single example, namely the Euler equations. And then everything is very specific, and so the discussion very closely follows this one physical case. But then it is sort of not obvious how to transfer this to other systems. And so the idea here is, although it might be a little sort of boring and sound a little bit abstract, but the power of this is that this is sort of the general formalism that allows you to apply the solution to any conservation law system. So. Sort of with this knowledge at hand, essentially one can write a Riemann solver that just works in sort of all cases, be it sort of magneto hydrodynamics, be it general relativistic hydrodynamics, be it the Euler equations, be it some approximations to radiation transport that we discussed in chapter two earlier in the course. So this is really sort of the power of the formalism in some sense. Okay, so and then the program will be for Thursday to finish the discussion on K rarefaction waves and then move on to shocks and contact discontinuities. And then early next week, we'll finish the discussion of the Riemann problem and then get back to numerics. Okay, if any, yeah?
Can I ask an off-topic question real quick?
Oh yeah, sure, of course.
This is for Eric Poisson. I was recommended a book by my advisor, Relativist Toolkit. Are you the author of this book?
Yeah, I am.
That is pretty cool. I just noticed that. I don't suppose you mind if I ask you some questions over email or something.
No, about it. That's fine.
Okay, thank you.
Great, we made a new connection.
Yeah, I just happened to put together the two names. I was like, oh.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, and if any questions come up in the meanwhile, so tomorrow I'll be on Zoom for questions at 1:30, I believe, the usual time. So if people want to ask questions or just about anything, I'll be there. Other than that, see you all on Thursday.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.